This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Next Tuesday, voters are going to decide who will lead the city of Cincinnati over the next 4 years. Incumbent John Cranley was sworn in as mayor in December 2013. He was a member of city council from 2000 to 2009. Yvette Simpson has served on city council since 2011. Both candidates join us this afternoon, along with WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. We aren't taking phone calls today, but you can still send your questions to talk@wvxu.org. And Councilmember Simpson, good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Mayor Cranley, thank you for being here, too.
Good afternoon.
And Howard, good to see you as well.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start off by asking each of you what you think is the biggest challenge that the city of Cincinnati faces. And let's go ahead. We'll let Mayor Cranley start, and then Councilmember Simpson, you can jump in.
Well, there's always many problems on our plates on a going forward basis, as such as life. But if I were to single out one, I would say that we want to continue to make progress, but need to make a lot more progress on poverty and expanding opportunity to more people. We're seeing tremendous job growth, which is good. We're seeing repopulation and reinvestment in the city, which is wonderful. I'm very proud of our record of progress on that front. And we are seeing progress on poverty. We've seen the poverty reduction of children go down over the last 4 years. We've seen overall poverty go down by a significant amount. But it's not enough if you're still living in poverty. And so our efforts to help people move into the middle class with job training, transportation, health care, child care, I think are important. And I'm very proud of our public-private partnership and the Child Poverty Collaborative to try to find private resources to match city dollars to make a community-based, broad-based initiative to reduce poverty. And as I've said many times, we'll keep pursuing the GE skyscrapers, the Amazon.com deals, but we also want to bring the bottom up, and I think that will be a real piece of our character.
Mm-hmm. Councilmember Simpson, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to discuss just one. We've got a heroin epidemic that's out of control. I think we still have too many shootings and homicides in our city. Certainly, poverty is an issue that matters to me. My strategy around poverty is around making sure that we improve the places where people live, because the research suggests that if you want to improve someone's life, you improve their environment. And so we have to make sure we're rebuilding neighborhoods in a way that we haven't before, and making sure our children, no matter where they grow up, they have a safe environment that is clean, that is investing in their future. And so a lot of our work around poverty has been centered around making sure that our places where kids live are better suited to serve them, and that we have strategies that start with the voice of those in poverty first, and that we allow them to be a part of their own prosperity. We allow them to be a part of the solution making and to help each other. We found that there are many families who are suffering from poverty who are making it work. How do we create stability with those families so we can take them to the next level? So that a lot of our work is around that critical issue. I think the most important opportunity for our city is really to take advantage of the renaissance that we've had and the fact that cities are centers again, and to really build our city from the ground up, starting with our neighborhoods and out, building opportunities to build a diverse economy with small businesses and manufacturing, which is, I think, an opportunity for us to go back to the past and do it better with advanced manufacturing, healthcare, tech, and IT tech, and to make sure that we're using new strategies to keep people safe.
And Mayor Cranley, I'd like to ask you, too, what do you see as, since Councilmember Simpson talked about the opportunities, what do you see as being the biggest opportunities for Cincinnati?
I think putting together a comprehensive public transportation plan that dramatically increases bus routes and frequency throughout the entire county to help people get to and from their jobs is one of those major things that we have to accomplish as a community over the next 4 years. I think that, you know, my vision is to integrate streetcar, bus, Uber, taxi, and Lyft. It is a critical need for people who don't own a car to be able to get to and from their jobs and their homes. It's a critical need for employers. And I see the getting something done significant. I've proposed a 50% increase to the public funding for transportation. I think getting a comprehensive plan in place would be a major opportunity.
You have suggested through a countywide sales tax.
Yeah, every other major urban county in Ohio has one, like Columbus and Cleveland and Toledo and Dayton, and virtually every county, urban county in the country has a countywide transit tax. We're the only city that I know of that doesn't have one, and that's why we're deeply underfunded compared to our peers.
But getting rid of the portion of the city earnings tax.
Well, I certainly don't believe that our people should be double taxed. So if we were to pass one, but Howard, as you know, or maybe we haven't talked about this, I'm not sure. My proposal would be that if we can convince the county to pass the tax, which would take the funding from roughly $50 million to $75 million, we would be able to reduce the city tax burden. But I am proposing that we keep a portion of it to add to the Smail Commission permanently, point one, which would be about $17 million a year. And that would be added to the existing Smail Commission, which requires it to be spent on deferred maintenance of roads, bridges, parks, recreations, things that are existing assets, because I believe long-term we need – although we've made a huge effort to improve our public roads and bridges, I believe to have the properly funded deferred maintenance, we need additional resources.
Councilmember Simpson, do you have a different view of how we should go about – putting together a real regional transit system?
I do. I mean, I think the first thing we have to do is take a look at our current system and find out, I think, very specifically why it's not working and how we serve more people. So Columbus did this, Houston did this, several other cities have gone through that comprehensive planning with the community engagement piece. Columbus was able to serve 100,000 more riders as a result of reorganizing their routes. They did spend some capital money on the study, but they didn't spend another operational dollar in serving 100,000 more people, which is where we need to start, because we know that our city has shifted, our region has shifted where people live and where people work since the last time we've done a comprehensive study.
So you're
study.
Saying we don't need an increase in sales tax?
I think we're probably going to need more resources, but the question is, where do we put those resources once we have them? Because the reality is the plan that John has articulated sort of said doesn't get us anything new, right?
That's not true.
They said it does not work.
That's not true either.
Well, hang on. We'll let you respond.
It's documented, as always, when I make comments like that. But my plan is to, one, study our current route system and improve it. I'm advocating for a bold vision, right? Making sure we have exactly what we need for the transit system of the future. And that includes making sure we have crosstown routes, making sure we're connecting more directly to job centers, making sure we have extended hours and a frequency that people can rely on. Also, making sure we have capital investments in bus rapid transit and rail, I think, is something that we need to look at. I think we get one shot at this, and we have to do it in a way, I think, that's going to work for the next 50 years.
Let's allow Mayor Cranley to respond to that briefly.
Yeah, I mean, it's the land of magical thinking. I mean, we are deeply underfunded on public transportation on a per capita basis than all of our regional peers, all of them. We need more resources. The difference is I have the courage to tell the public that we do. The council member says we can get all this magical new ridership without any additional resources. Life doesn't work that way. If it was easy, they would have done it. And in fact, sort of has said if we do nothing, which is what Councilmember Simpson is doing other
that
than to optimize routes – we will see the continued destruction of the public transportation system that we have. The fact is this has been studied and researched, and there are deeply underfunded. I do not believe we have enough resources committed to public transportation, and I am proposing – and I agree it's not politically popular to say to do this, but I believe I will lead and say we need more resources for public transportation, and it's misleading bus riders or anyone else to think we can improve the bus system without additional resources.
Let's move on to a kind of a related subject.
Yeah.
I'm very much interested in this Amazon proposal that was made recently as basically an initial proposal.
Right.
And there are 238
cities and regions
in the United States that are competing for this. And as I looked at the list of things that were being proposed to Amazon from the city of Cincinnati, the one glaring thing that seemed to be there was the public transportation piece of it. I mean, do we have a public transportation system right now that could handle that kind of a development?
Is that for me?
Yeah.
Well, I think we can win the bid. I think we can win the bid. We're pursuing it. I think that one of the greatest things about our city's renaissance is that we believe we can be competitive and win this thing. Obviously, who knows if we're going to win. But I think we got a real shot. I agree with you that one thing our community is lacking that we need more of is more options for public transportation, which is why I proposed a 50% increase in the public transportation budget so we could have more buses, integrate the streetcar, Uber, taxi, and Lyft to get people to and from their jobs and to their homes. We absolutely need more public transportation, which is why I put out a real plan with real dollars.
Hey, Council Member Simpson.
So to directly answer the question, I don't think so. I mean, we can get the bid, I think, because of all the other great things that are happening and because we're a small city, I think, with the potential to be able to make investments. But I suspect that if Amazon chooses us, they're going to expect us to make significant improvements, not just in transit, but in infrastructure to be able to support 50,000 new people, new jobs in our region. Maybe all of them might not be new people, but 50,000 new jobs in our region. So I believe that we will have to invest aggressively in the transit system of the future. I mean, you have to think about where their current headquarters is. They right. have amazing transit, and they can go to any city. And their cities have done a lot more innovative and aggressive transit infrastructure investment, and we haven't. And it really is beginning to be the difference between the haves and the have-nots. Nashville just agreed to invest $5 billion in their regional system. They're welcoming almost 100 people every day to Nashville because of the strategic investments that they're making towards growth. So if we get it, it'll be because we laid out a great plan. I think what we're going to have to spend in order to build up that infrastructure to be able to support all those people, whether it be transit or actually additional housing, of course, roads to support all these additional people coming into our city. We're going to have to reinforce all of that as well. So I think we're going to have to put quite a bit of money
today. Those things do not exist.
I don't think so. I mean, right? I think the fact that it takes a person 2 hours to go from Walnut Hills to Mount Airy, cross town each way. Amazon's not going to go for that. I mean, a hub and spoke model just does not work.
Okay.
So we've got to have a better system.
Let me be clear. I thought I heard Councilmember Simpson said we can't win. I believe we can win.
I didn't say that.
I thought you said we don't have
this. She thinks we can do this. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I'm glad. We can win. I do believe long-term, as I said at the beginning, one of the opportunities for our community is to develop a real public transportation improvement plan that's comprehensive with real dollars. You can talk about it all you want, but it takes money. It takes a real plan. It takes a real commitment, which is what we've laid out. And we have a track record of getting things done, and we'll work on getting this done too.
We will continue our conversation with Yvette Simpson and John Cranley. You can send us your questions to talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. We're talking with the candidates in the Cincinnati mayor's race, incumbent John Cranley and Cincinnati Council member Yvette Simpson. If you have any questions for the candidates, send it by email, talk@wvxu.org. And a transportation-related question that we got by email from Hans. He says he's just curious what your positions are on a streetcar extension.
Mm-hmm. I think streetcar is and I think rail is probably a better word to use, but I think it's a part of the multimodal transportation system we need to build out for the future. You know, right now we're hyper-focused on buses because we've been alerted over the last few years how critical the need is for our buses. And so we need to make sure that footprint is built out. But I do believe that we invested in not a 3.6-mile loop, but in, I think, a rail system that was going to connect our entire region. And I think that's still a long-term goal that we should be striving for. We know that rail is the transportation system of the future. It brings economic development. It connects people more intently and specifically, and it provides predictability for a certain corridor that are important. So back when on my first term, when we had a really robust transportation conversation going, we talked about the main corridors, and one of them is Reading Road. Reading Road is an opportune corridor for bus rapid transit or rail. We had talked about if we ever could get the regional support to do light rail, 71 corridor is one of the most opportune from the airport all the way out to Mason. And this is the kind of big picture thinking that I think if we're going to be a city of the future, we've at least got to talk about it.
So you support the idea of extending?
I still do, but okay. I think the first page has to be getting this bus system under control, and I think that's first and foremost.
Now, Mayor, you talk about the mix that you want to see. Where does either rail or the streetcar fit into that?
Well, this is a clear difference between us. I mean, the fact is that the only legislation that Councilmember Simpson has supported on transportation is to extend the streetcar. My plan is to expand bus service and routes with real dollars and a real plan. I do not believe the priority should be to extend the streetcar when so many people are not being able to access their jobs. And expanding and improving bus service is the most efficient way, and I believe we have an obligation to spend dollars the most efficiently on a marginal basis. I do want, obviously, the streetcar to succeed. It's a nice-to-have thing, but not a got-to-have thing. I think the got-to-have is increasing public transportation options throughout the county or broader with bus, streetcar, integrating that, and also figuring out how to take advantage of the future, which is a rideshare economy of Uber, taxi, and Lyft. And in fact, I'm in negotiations directly with Uber to have – they're going to invest some of their own money to help integrate our system, improve the technology opportunities, and help some lower-income folks get to and from their job on the last mile or the first mile. That, to me, is a future-oriented vision of public transportation.
On transportation and infrastructure, obviously the Western Hills Viaduct is a major problem that needs to be addressed and is being addressed by both the city and the county. I mean, it's basically the county's problem, but it's, you know, the city obviously is a part of this. I think tonight the county commissioners are holding a public hearing on a proposed $5 fee on motor vehicle registration to help pay for this. I'd like to hear from both of you on whether or not you support that idea. Mayor?
Absolutely. And I'm committing that within 4 years, we will have the funding in place to fix the Western Hills Viaduct. I think it is a critical item, and we will get it done.
How much of a piece will the $5 fee be?
Well, under the current formula, that would get us the local match. And through a combination of state dollars and Commissioner Portune's plan from the Museum Center tax would be enough to cover the difference. And I commend him for having the political courage to put that out there, and I support it. It must get done. It will get done. And just as I put my mind to improving economic inclusion or reducing poverty or paving more roads, I can promise that we'll have the funding in place in 4 years to reconstruct the Western Hills Viaduct.
Does that sound realistic to you?
It doesn't. I don't see any money in the city's going forward capital budget set aside for the Western Hills Viaduct. It's a $330-some million project. We've applied for grant funding, but we're not sure we're going to get it all. And we should continue to apply, but I don't see $330 million in the future. I don't see it in our budget. I'm hoping that the proposal that the county puts forward will help us get there, but I don't think those two together even gets us $330 million all told. I guess assuming that we get all the grants that we're applying for, yes, but that doesn't always happen. So I'd like for the city of Cincinnati to create a mega project in our capital budget for the Western Hills Viaduct like we did for Music Hall.
Would you support this $5 fee?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable fee to go towards infrastructure. You take something like roads, people's cars, and you redirect that towards where it belongs, which is paying for road infrastructure. I think that makes sense. The sales tax question, I haven't been able to evaluate yet, meaning taking the Union Terminal sales tax. I think that on top of the sort of tax, we've got to see kind of how that impacts people. We don't know what's going to happen with the stadiums yet and how that's going to roll up and roll out in the coming years. So I just haven't had the chance yet to really evaluate the full formula. I don't see 4 years and $330 million, but if the county believes they have that, I think that's wonderful. Like I said, the city hasn't set aside enough resources, I don't think, to provide the match that we're going to need.
But you're guaranteeing it, Mayor, right?
I mean, it's about priorities. I mean, Councilmember Simpson did find $100 million in capital for the streetcar. If it's important to you, you can get it done. And I can tell you, having driven the Western Hills Viaduct most of my life, it's important. And I think the West Side deserves more attention in general, and the Western Hills Viaduct is a critical artery to the West Side. And if you think about the $5 fee that the county is going to do, Todd Portune's plan, state grants, and if we can find $100 million for the streetcar, it seems to me we can find $100 million to serve 80,000 people a day who are riding and depending on a Western Hills Viaduct to get to and from their
home. But he hasn't set aside any of that money in a five-year capital plan. So if we're going to have it done in the 4 years, then why isn't the money set aside in the capital plan? It doesn't grow on trees, as he said. It doesn't come out of the sky. So where is that money going to come from? And there hasn't been a commitment from this mayor to set that money aside. And so what I'm saying is if we're going to be serious about it, then let's find find out what our match is going to be, and let's put that money aside.
Well, let's go on to another question, too. Okay. This one from Gwen.
Yeah.
Gwen wanted to know which economic issue is more important to you, strengthening the Cincinnati retirement system so it can be transferred to the Ohio Public Employee Retirement System, or extending the streetcar route to Clifton?
Oh, absolutely. The pension is very, very important. I mean, you know, we, you know, and John can talk about the negotiation work that our lawyers did with our unions to make that deal happen. But we already see that it's not going to be sufficient for the future. We, our current employees don't have retiree health care because the health care plan, we took money from the health care plan and put it over into the regular pension. So all new employees don't have retiree health care, which is, I think, going to be a challenge for the future. We still have some underfunding in that health care trust that has to be remedied. And we don't know what's going to happen in the future because we didn't budget for recessions. So if there's a recession and the investment income from our retirement goes way, way down, it's a reopener for the consent decree, but we don't have the money set aside to fill that gap in the event that that happens, and that would be the city's obligation to take care of. So I do think the priority is to get to a place where if OPERS would be willing to take our retirees, and we can get an agreement on that because our employees would be taking, again, cuts and adjustments to their promised retirement, then I think that would be certainly the priority.
Mayor.
I think people forget that 4 years ago, we were facing bankruptcy, $800 million in unfunded pension liability. S&P and Moody's had downgraded the city's credit. In our first year, I did some really tough things. I went to the unions and retirees, and I asked them to give up pension benefits for the good of the city, the good of the pension. But that's the kind of leadership that I provide, is making the tough calls, making the hard choices. And I think people know that with our leadership, we'll continue to do the right thing for the city, even when it's politically unpopular, because we restored that fiscal foundation of the city, and we earned an upgrade from S&P and Moody's last year as a result of that. And so I think part of our – people forget that part of our success is rebuilding that foundation of a balanced budget, structurally balanced budget, of dealing with tough issues that have been ignored for years, like the pension crisis. And upon that success, we're seeing GE and Kroger and Children's and all these other great investments in our city because they have a partner that's financially credible.
Well, the pension failed under his leadership. He was on the pension board when we started to see failures and redirected $50 million in Anthem money that should have gone into the pension. So he knows this better than most. We started to see structural imbalance when he was chair of budget and finance. This was before I got here. I was in law school at the time. And so it's very interesting to take credit for the fact that we're fixing these things now. But those very problems that he's saying have been kicked down the can for years were created by him.
Mayor, do you want to respond?
Well, that's not true. I mean, when I was on council, I'm proud of the work that we did to come out of 2001 and negotiate the collaborative agreement. I'm proud of starting the Renaissance in downtown over the Rhine with 3CDC and the TIF districts that helped pay for Washington Park's improvement, et cetera. It's true that after the Great Recession, that the pension was under siege. And when I was elected mayor, I was out of office for 5 years, 6 years. And when I came in, we were facing an $800 million unfunded pension liability. It did take me 1 year to negotiate it. But I think that's pretty amazing speed. And it wasn't easy, as I mentioned. I had to ask people to give up benefits for the greater good of the city. And I'm proud to say that at the end of the day, the retirees and the union supported that deal.
Now, Liz has a related question that she sent us, Mayor. And she wanted both of you to comment on the mayor and council getting involved in police and fire contracts when – really, it seems as that should be the job of the city manager.
Both of us have a track record of doing that, from the paid leave to my proposal, which Councilmember Simpson supported. You know, the fact is that our police and firefighters and our sanitation workers and our sewer district workers had gone through the Great Recession with no cost of living increase, and the proposal I made was to bring them up to present day cost of living. Now, they didn't get back pay for that. They went 6 years without, and I stand by that decision. I think it was the right decision.
I agree with your listener that it is the job of the city manager to negotiate with our bargaining units, and I think having fought really hard with our unions on the non-SB5 effort was one of the reasons I hesitated to support it in the first place. It was not because our workers don't deserve raises. Clearly they do. But when an elected official gets involved in negotiations and says, we're going to set your rate, I mean, it's a dangerous precedent for the future.
Why did you support it?
I actually added language that said that we are not violating collective bargaining to the ordinance that I ultimately passed. And I knew that it was the only way that we were going to get raises at that time. The legislation that we passed on paid parental leave was not a labor agreement. It was a citywide change to our policy that affected not just labor, but our non-represented. My opponent's legislation only affected labor unions, which is what made it so challenging to collective bargaining, is they were already in the middle of labor negotiations when my opponent decided he wanted to set the rates, which I think is dangerous precedent for the future, which is okay. one of the reasons why Vice Mayor Mann voted against
it.
She was against it before she was for it. The fact is that the city manager always takes the position, as he should. And remember, I recommended the city manager that never should legislative bodies interfere with any of this stuff. But the fact is that Councilmember Simpson and I both put forward paid leave policies that the manager also wished hadn't happened. I put forth a living wage law that Councilmember Simpson supported that the city manager didn't want. And the fact is that I think it's a good, healthy discussion and debate to have. But the fact is that Councilmember Simpson is trying to have it both ways. She's both criticizing it, but she supported it.
Well, that's why I'm running, because I think the better way to do it is for the leadership of our city, the mayor, to actually make sure the process is right the first time, not to have to clean it up when it's already a mess. And I think I was very vocal about the fact that I didn't like the process, but I did want our workers to get raises. The cart was already out of the horse, and we had to make the best of that situation once it was already out.
But I believe in standing on principle.
But I think we need to move on. At this
okay.
point.
Yeah. Okay.
You'll get a straight answer from me.
All right. One thing that I've heard from people in the neighborhoods and also a number of the city council candidates, believe it or not, have been talking about neighborhood development and, you know, the fact that there are many neighborhoods in this city that do not have nonprofit neighborhood development corporations that can, you know, help them spur development in their communities. How do we get the help to those communities? I mean, some council member or council candidates have actually suggested to me that 3CDC ought to go around and give seminars to neighborhood leaders and say, here's how you do it. Does that make sense, Mayor?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I come to this having, you know, done it myself. You know, when I left the council, I went back to Price Hill and started the Incline Public House and the district, Incline District Development, that ultimately led to a wonderful theater that is now, you know, has performances over 100 nights a year. And we did that during a great recession. We had, you know, 28 banks that turned us down. But we worked with the community council, with the development corporations there to make something happen.
But there were community development corporations there.
There was.
To work with.
Absolutely. No. If you look at the neighborhoods that are seeing the fastest turnaround right now, from mm-hmm. Madisonville to Walnut Hills to Price Hill to Westwood to College Hill, just to name a few, they all have highly functional some are developing. Most of them have highly functional development corporations. The nonprofit development corporations are the grassroots bread and butter that are helping to bring back these neighborhoods. It's awesome.
But they aren't in all 52 neighborhoods.
No, they're not. And it does require neighborhoods to take some, you know, leadership, you know, from the bottom up. But there's no question that our best partnerships are with neighborhoods that have really done it. And look at Woodburn Avenue and Walnut Hills. Look at mm-hmm. Madison and Wetzel. Look at Hamilton Avenue and College Hill. It's incredible.
Councilmember Simpson, how do you spur this?
So these neighborhoods didn't do it by themselves. I mean, I was proud to be a part of the neighborhood planning process that led to the very strategies that Walnut Hills, College Hill, Madisonville, and Westwood are leaning into right now. You know, we need a more robust planning department to help neighborhoods come up with neighborhood plans. And we need our community and economic development department to be a community development department as well as an economic development department. Yes, we have these neighborhood groups that have the wherewithal, and that's wonderful. We give them $5, they turn it into $5,000. But we also need to make sure, and we will through our Ready, Set, Go plan and our neighborhood support fund program, make sure that all neighborhoods have the opportunity to have the investment they need. We have professionals in our own offices that can do capacity building, not just 3CDC, but we have great developers and great development partners within our own administration that need to be at the table working with neighborhoods, and we can bring professionals in to work with neighborhoods to do planning. I think the part that's missing is the planning piece, making sure neighborhoods can come to the table and say, here's what we want to see, and have the administration, outside resources, and others help with that process. If we just say you have to have someone in your community who knows how to do this, who has the time, there are going to be neighborhoods all the time that are going to be left behind. It's up to us to make sure that we fill the gap.
Question from Jeff. He wants to know what you would do to reduce the amount of gun violence in the city. Mayor, why don't we start with you?
Oh, it's like the heroin issue. It's a public health epidemic. As people may know, I joined up with Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Mom Demand Action. We had a massive press conference in Westwood combined with the mothers of children who have been murdered in our community, combined with Citizens on Patrol, combined with our outreach workers from Human Relations Commission. Fundamentally, there are way too many guns on the street. And, of course, the right-wingers that have governed in the state and in Washington have tied a lot of our hands in being able to take illegal guns off the street. However, the good news is there's still some strong laws on the books that we can enforce. And so we have two lawyers who work day in and day out with the U.S. Attorney's Office, embedded in the U.S. Attorney's Office, because federal law on illegal guns, because if you have a felony conviction, you're not allowed to have a gun at all. You're not allowed to possess a gun. And so what we're able to do is go after repeat violent offenders through collaboration with our U.S. Attorney, FBI, ATF partners, and really track down people that are involved in these shootings. In fact, in a lot of these shootings, we can't get witnesses to come forward, but our officers often know who did it. And so we can get them on illegal gun charges and get those individuals off the street.
So you're talking about enforcing the existing gun laws?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would love to get more gun safety laws on the books, but the state legislature keeps taking away our ability to do that. But in the meantime, we want to enforce the laws that are there and work with – you know, I started the Ohio Mayor's Alliance of all top 30 cities in Ohio, Democratic and Republican. And we are lobbying the state to stop taking away the home rule abilities to reduce and further weaken gun law. Right now, they're trying to pass a law to allow people to take guns into bars and restaurants. I mean, that's a terrible idea. And so we are lobbying also to not further weaken the gun laws.
Councilmember Simpson.
So our approach is to use violence prevention, which is a CDC-proven model to prevent violence before it happens. I think, you know, all of John's suggestions are reactive, and I think we need at least one solid strategy that is proactive. We have the best law enforcement team in the country, but they can't prevent a gun from coming out of the barrel. And I think it's important for us to make sure that we have a preventative strategy. So we've got a couple pilots going on that I'd like to expand as mayor, working with families, individuals, and communities to actually treat the trauma that results in violence. There is a direct correlation with personal violence and neighborhood violence to then resulting person becoming violent. I mean, that the data is clear, and we can actually prevent violence before it happens. Several major cities are doing the same work. We're probably the smallest municipality doing this work, and that's because they believe that they have more shootings than us, and we don't need to. I believe we implement that strategy here, we can see a sustained, significant reduction in violence. And what we know is that there are certain people more exposed. How do we get those people who are exposed the treatment that they need so that they never pick up a gun? Because, you know, making sure we don't get guns into the hands of our children, making sure illegal guns don't get into our streets are a major issue. But keeping the person who would eventually grab that gun from picking up that gun is a real strategy that we have to lean into.
But and that we're strategy saying, takes we're saying time.
Here, Howard. We'll sure. take a break here and we'll come back to your sure. thought. So more with John Cranley and Yvette Simpson, and you can send your questions to talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. We're talking with Mayor John Cranley and Cincinnati Councilmember Yvette Simpson. On Tuesday, voters will decide which of them is going to lead the city for the next 4 years. And you can email your questions to us, talk@wvxu.org. Howard, before we went to the break, you had something you wanted to go into. I had to,
yeah,
had to cut you
that's
off.
That's all right. No, it's just listening to you talk about the gun problem. It sounded to me almost like, couldn't there be a combination of your strategy, Councilmember Simpson, and your more immediate, let's get the guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them? I mean, why can't we do both?
I think we have to do both. I mean, and I'm advocating that we do both. I'm the only one that's advancing the violence prevention strategy, which unfortunately we're just not doing enough. I mean, we don't have enough resources in that strategy.
Is that true?
No.
Okay.
In fact, of course we've got to do both. The question was specifically about illegal guns on the street, but broader, I absolutely agree with Councilmember Simpson that we have to build better opportunities for neighborhoods and individuals to escape poverty and to have opportunity and to be in better places, more rec centers, more, you know, the Boys and Girls Club that I promoted that we're now going to build in the Old Fay Apartments, one of our highest crime, highest poverty neighborhoods. These are part of a comprehensive approach to hard and soft approach to these issues. So, of course, we should and will do both and are doing both.
My strategy isn't just providing opportunities for people. It's a very data-driven and trauma-informed strategy. We're working with UC Health, which does PTSD work with individuals who are returning from war because they found that kids in communities like Avondale and others that are exposed to lots of shootings are exhibiting signs of PTSD, meaning they can't function because they hear gunshots constantly. Our approach is a data-driven, trauma-informed measure that says, let's reverse what's happening in the lives of these people that causes them to be so desensitized to violence that they pick up a gun either in defense of themselves or because they just don't know any better because their brain chemistry has changed so significantly. That's direct work that is working in other places. I certainly support, you know, rebuilding communities. That's our strategy. But this violence prevention strategy is very specific, and we haven't gotten nearly enough support from my opponent in this administration to fund those initiatives.
Well, hold on for a second. The council member's been in office for 6 years, and she's never introduced legislation to do any of that.
We actually are doing it.
You have no money or legislation presented on that. However,
$500,000 of money.
So it,
from
that,
where?
That we,
from
that
the Human Services Fund.
So we are doing some of that.
Yeah, but part of the money we tried to increase was redirected in this budget, and we actually need a lot more.
Right, but again, she's been in office for 6 years and has never proposed to do more or how she would pay for it. But what I do know is that we've tripled funding for human services over the last 3 years. We have our Child Poverty Collaborative that's moving forward with private sector help, and the council member voted against our Hand Up initiative and criticized the Child Poverty Collaborative instead of rolling up her sleeves and working together. Certainly, the ideas that she just mentioned about PTSD and helping on mental health issues affecting kids is a great idea, and I'd be happy to work with her.
Councilmember Simpson, if you want to respond, then we'll move off.
Yes.
I don't need to respond. I mean, I think he brought up a lot of things there. My criticism of the Child Poverty Collaborative was, one, I didn't think it was ground up enough, and two years later, and we still don't have recommendations, which I was more worried about the fact that we were announcing that we were lifting 10,000 kids out of poverty 2 years ago without a plan. And here we are 2 years later, and we're just starting to see recommendations. So, of course, poverty is important, but as someone who grew up in it, I want to make sure that we're being as realistic as we can about our ability to be able to do this work and that we're making sure that the most consistent voice at every decision-making table are the people who are in poverty. And I didn't see that in the initial schematic of the plan. I think they're redirecting and getting back there now, but that wasn't the original plan and strategy, unfortunately.
Heidi would like to know what city spending areas you would be willing to cut to reduce the tax burden. Mayor?
Well, I think it's always a case of what are your priorities first, and then you cut what's not in those priorities. And I don't say that lightly. We inherited a structurally unbalanced budget. For four straight years, we've structurally balanced the budget by making the tough choices. Obviously, safety is always the most important issue. We'll continue that. The basic services like road paving and sanitation and making sure our parks and recreations are open and available, and our health centers. And obviously, as we've discussed, this hard and soft approach to reducing poverty and expanding opportunity, I think continuing to invest in human services and job training is critical. Everything that, you know, isn't in that list, you know, would be subject to anything we need to do in order to maintain and to balance the budget. And I have vetoed property tax increases that the council passed because I do believe we have to live within our budgets. I'm not in any way other than this idea of the transportation countywide approach that could reduce the city's income tax. That's a conditional thing. It wouldn't happen on its own. Other than that, I'm not proposing – I don't think it's responsible to say that I can lower taxes, but I will commit to staying within the tax structure without having to raise property taxes. And I vetoed the last property tax increase.
Councilmember Simpson.
But he advanced a property tax increase for a $100 million slush fund. So those two things are incongruent. I will say for myself that I think we need to streamline administration.
And I want to give him a chance to respond to that real quickly.
Yeah. Okay. Explain yourself and then let
I'm talking about the park levy.
Okay. I see.
Which is on record. He advanced that he had vetoed our attempts to increase the property tax, which isn't true. And what I advanced in response was he also introduced a property tax increase that was failed at the ballot for a park levy, which I call a slush fund because it was not about the parks. Many of the projects were not park projects, frankly. My plan in response to the question is that we should streamline our administration. I think we can find a lot of savings by taking a look at how we centralize our administration. Right now, we have a decentralized model. I think we're not using technology to make sure that we're improving the people process side of it. When we did a priority-based budget, which I think we should do, we can go within each department and itemize and rank each program within each department and determine which programs within each department are most essential. That way we don't have to do 5% across the board, 10% across the board cuts, because I think those types of cuts are the ones that are challenging, because now you've got essential programs that are being cut because certain departments can't go 10% in order to be responsive. So I want to make that very, very clear that I think we need to go to a program-based, community-based budget process.
Okay. You said a lot of things there. I think
we've all said a lot.
He needs to, yeah.
Let me just respond to a couple of those things. As a general principle, I think that if the government's going to raise taxes, I think it should be voted on by the people. And so it's true I advanced a way to make sure that our parks and facilities are properly maintained, and the voters turned it down. But I promise I will not do that without asking the voters, and I'm happy to listen to the voters when they have different priorities. It is a fact that in December of 2015, my opponent, Councilmember Simpson, voted to raise the property tax of the city, and I vetoed it. And that veto was sustained, thank God, and I was able to prevent that property tax increase.
That is actually not true. What we were trying to figure out was it was within a decimal point. You know, we have a rollback, and so we have to collect $28.9 million every year. Our budget director was afraid that if we set the millage at 2 decimal points back, that we would be short of that $28.9 million. And to be safe, they advised us to make sure that we brought it up to 1 decimal point. I mean, literally, he's talking about a decimal point to ensure that we get the $28.9 million, because once it's set, if it's not enough and the auditor can't collect it, we won't get that $28.9 million.
That's a long way of saying she raised property
taxes. It was not
tax.
A raise in property taxes.
Can we resolve
taxes?
This in like 30 seconds?
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that it's misleading to say that it was a property tax increase, because what we were trying to figure out was what was the appropriate millage to get the 28.9.
I think property taxes are too high, and I vetoed the increase.
Question from Mark. Would you be willing to co-sign a letter to the Cincinnati Election Commission petitioning to stop allowing limited liability corporations to contribute large sums to candidates?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it takes a charter amendment, but yeah, I support that.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, I do.
And that's become an issue.
Yes.
In this campaign. Because, I mean, you've had quite a number of those.
We both have, but certainly you've had more. Well, sure.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, as I've said many times, the support that we've received is, I think, driven dramatically this year by the difference we took to Children's Hospital, where I took a collaborative approach. My opponent took a hostile approach, and I think people were upset by that, and it's led to a significant amount of support.
He was raising LLC money before that happened, a lot of it.
Okay. So you'd both sign the
I think it's important.
Changing.
We need campaign finance reform.
Let's go back to this Children's Hospital issue for a moment. Your campaign has made quite a bit of Councilmember Simpson's stance on this when the zoning change came up, and she made a motion which would have required Children's Hospital to invest a whole lot more money in Avondale than they were already investing, and it failed. But you know, that's how the process works. I'm wondering, is it fair to attack her on that, because she was trying to help a particular neighborhood in Cincinnati and looking out for their interest, as she says?
Well, I think it's a difference of opinion. I think it's an issue-based contrast. Councilmember Simpson has said that she thought it was a visionary approach, and I assume that if she's mayor, she'll take that approach to a whole different set of issues. I believe that the expansion of Children's Hospital was good for Avondale, good for the neighborhood, and they were being offered tens of millions of dollars to go to Butler County. I've spent my adult life helping, you know, fighting against Jewish and Bethesda that left the city. And I think when Children's Hospital, which was not asking us for a dime, who does free primary care for the kids of Avondale, who tutors in the school, who are committed to inclusion in their construction project, are investing the single biggest investment in the history of the city, we should embrace that and collaborate with them, not try to pull the rug out from them at the last minute. It's a difference of opinion on how do you approach things, and I think it's a fair difference of opinion.
Okay. Councilmember Simpson, before you answer that, answer this for me. There's nothing inherently wrong about Children's Hospital Medical Center investing $550 million in Avondale, is there?
No, and I was in support of the expansion. I mean, I never wanted to stop the expansion.
What was your objection?
Well, the objection was the fact that they own a lot of property around the footprint of the hospital. There was no plan other than to keep that vacant. It was my understanding that Children's wanted to do more there. In my conversations, I thought they did, based on the model that they presented from Nationwide Hospital, Good Sam and Dayton. Examples we've seen in other cities, like in New York, where they are investing aggressively around the expansion footprint. I thought it was going to be accepted by Children's, frankly. We've got a good relationship. We did Vernon Manor together just the year before, and the city put capital dollar and TIF dollar to get that project done. And that was an incentive deal for Children's. So I thought it was going to be something that they thought would be a good thing to do, because that footprint around the hospital, if you look at what's happened in Cleveland with Cleveland Clinic, the area around that hospital is a disaster.
It's awful,
area.
Yeah. Right.
We don't want that to happen in Cincinnati.
But Children's Hospital had promised to invest over $11 million in Avondale.
Absolutely. But the area around the footprint still had no answer. And when I had talked to them, they seemed to be open to, when I talked about Project Reach, which is what the Redevelopment Authority does, takes those houses, redevelops them. They seemed amenable to that. So this was a part of that proposal. Do we take that housing, and rather than leave it vacant for four or more years, do we redevelop that as housing for doctors and nurses and people from the community to live together? This is just, I think, as a city, we've got to be able to have conversations where we say, we know you're a great stakeholder. We appreciate what you do. But can we together do more here? We were also going to invest $500,000 that Children's was paying for the public right-of-way back into that along with Children's, and maybe more in the future. The question now is what happens with that area around the footprint. And I think the city of Cincinnati is going to have to invest aggressively ourselves in that redevelopment.
We've got about 1 minute left here. So each of you, with 30 seconds each, what's your vision for the city?
You said 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Go.
Oh, great. You know, I envision a Cincinnati that is the number one urban city in the country. And we do that by continuing our growth, but also making sure that everyone in our city has an opportunity. And there are still too many places in our city that you wouldn't even drive through because you wouldn't find them safe. We need to make sure we have a safe, clean, and thriving city. And we have to make sure the people in our city are doing well. So I plan to be the mayor for everyone, and we're going to make our city greater for every single Cincinnatian.
Mayor Cranley.
We will continue our proven record of progress by reducing crime and improving safety of neighborhoods, continuing to add jobs, but also making sure they're living wage jobs for people transitioning out of poverty and into the middle class. We will continue to close racial disparities by improving our inclusion outcomes. We will continue to clean up neighborhoods with a housing court picking up the litter. We will build a comprehensive, truly regional public transportation system that moves more people to be able to live with or without a car, and we will clean up the environment. My plan, I didn't get to talk about, my solar panels at Lunkin Airport to take some of our energy consumption off the grid and into renewable resources.
Thank you to both of you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It goes fast.
Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley and Cincinnati Councilmember Yvette Simpson and WVXU Politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Cincinnatians are just days away from choosing their next mayor, but some voters have already cast their ballots. A look at early voting predictions on the next Cincinnati edition, plus crime victims' rights and drug pricing will be on the Ohio ballot. We break down Ohio issues 1 and 2, the backers and opponents of the issues, and the week's top stories, all ahead on Cincinnati Edition, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.